Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Today we are creating this show within the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama, and we are using their very new studio that was created due to the generous contribution of Mr. Quinton and Mrs. Marion Ward. Thank you to Mr. and Mrs. Ward for creating this very wonderful facility. Folks, today we are going to tackle a very important question that I know a great many of you can relate to. Are you left, right, or confused? This show today will be an introduction to libertarianism, and with us is our special guest, Mr. Jacob Hubert. Welcome, Jacob.
Well, thank you for having me.
Very good. Folks, I want you to know that Jacob is a lawyer by training who teaches law at Ohio Northern University in Columbus, Ohio, is it?
Well, it's a little further from that. It's in Ada, Ohio, kind of in the middle of Ohio somewhere.
Very good. He has a new book coming out in July this year, 2010, called Libertarianism Today. And today, you're going to get a sneak peek into that book. So, Jacob, let's start out with the first question that you address in the book. What is libertarianism?
Well, libertarianism is a political philosophy based on the idea that people should be free to do anything that they want to do that's peaceful, that doesn't hurt anybody else. The idea that morality is the same for everybody. People who are in government aren't special in this respect. Stealing is still stealing if the government does it and calls it taxes. Killing is still killing if the government does it and calls it a war. So those are the key concepts. And then the implications of those two important concepts are voluntary exchange, that is, people should be free to voluntarily interact with each other, and private property rights. You should be able to invade on my person or my property.
So, you know, under this libertarianism idea, you know, the governments couldn't tax because they couldn't regulate peaceful behavior and they couldn't wage war. Is that correct?
That's true. That's absolutely an implication. Taxing is stealing, according to libertarianism.
Okay. Now, because governments depend on large-scale aggression, you know, they depend actually on really four different ways to fund themselves. They depend on taxing, borrowing, inflating, and war. Tell us about the role of war, this dependency on large-scale aggression.
Well, war, you know, as Randolph Bourne put it, is the health of the state. It's war is a way the government works people up, and people, when they feel threatened by an outside aggressor, they're the most inclined to give things up to government. They're the most inclined to allow themselves to be taxed, to allow themselves to be regulated more heavily at home. I mean, people alive today can remember the extreme deprivation people underwent for World War II, rationing and all that sort of thing. And when people are convinced that it's necessary for a war, people will give government a lot. And then, of course, after the war is over, they get some of their liberty back, but not as much as they had before.
Well, the work of Bob Higgs has shown that whenever governments expand themselves due to war, I believe he calls it the ratchet effect.
Right, that's what he calls it, and he's absolutely right. He's definitely the leading thinker in that area.
Yeah. So what do libertarians offer as an alternative? What do they favor?
Libertarians offer peaceful interaction. They offer trade, and in trade as opposed to a coerced exchange, everyone benefits. And so libertarians simply favor letting people interact peacefully, letting people do things voluntarily, and to build a peaceful civil society in that way.
And how do libertarians see government?
Many libertarians view government as simply a successful and well-respected criminal gang. They depend on a crime of taxation, theft, for their existence. And so many libertarians view the government not as a benevolent institution ever, but simply as an aggressive criminal organization.
Plus one that is fairly incompetent in everything it does.
That too.
Yeah. So, folks, we're going to wrap up this particular segment. We're coming on into a break, so please stay with us. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. This is Michael McKay. You're listening to Radio Free Market, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Please stay with us. And we're back. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and with me is Mr. Jacob Hubert. And we're talking about what is libertarianism, or as I like to introduce it, are you left, right, or are you confused? So we were just talking about how libertarians see government, and you were, during the break, making an additional comment on that, Jacob. Please go ahead. It was about the competency that we see.
Oh, of course, right, yes. Well, not only is government sort of criminal and evil in many respects, it's also incompetent to do the things that it tries to do, even if it did have the best of intentions. We can see that in a lot of different ways. I mean, there's some that are more benign than others. I mean, one example we all deal with, of course, is the post office. The incompetence you see there, the poor customer service you see, you have to go stand in line. People aren't friendly and so forth because they don't have to be. They're not a regular business. They don't face any competition. And you see ever less service. For example, now they're talking about reducing post office service to just 5 days a week and raising the prices at the same time. In the private sector, typically what you see are prices going down and the quality of service improving. You see the exact opposite when government tries to run businesses. Amtrak, of course, is another example. It loses millions and millions of dollars every year. It's a complete failure because consumers don't want it. The government doesn't provide good service, and they just keep doing it.
So are libertarian ideas new?
No, libertarian ideas aren't really new. The idea of human liberty has a long history, going back to ancient thinkers and then through Cicero with the Romans and Thomas Aquinas and various liberal thinkers up through the 19th century. What we think of as modern libertarianism grows a little bit out of a group called the Old Right, that a group of thinkers that existed before World War II, opposed the New Deal, maybe opposed World War II, a lot of them. And then after World War II, what we really think of as the modern libertarian movement started in 1946, I believe, when the Foundation for Economic Education was founded, and numerous groups have formed since then that have spread the message in a variety of ways.
Now, you mentioned in your book that these ideas of greater freedom and less government are not untested, that, you know, virtually every libertarian policy that has been implemented somewhere in the past have actually borne fruit, and the lack of them have created a disaster. Can you give us some examples of that?
Sure. I mean, we've had libertarian policies in practically every area at some point in some place in the United States. One, for example, is drugs. You know, for most of America's history, drugs were legal and people used them. You could go to the drugstore and buy cocaine-related medicines or buy heroin even, and people used these. And true, some people became addicted, but we didn't have a huge disaster. There weren't junkies littering the streets everywhere. You know, families everywhere weren't torn apart by drugs, as they are now. And life went along just fine. The push to ban drugs didn't come from a crisis of drug addiction so much as it came from special interests who didn't want that kind of competition. It was convenient for the U.S., to advance its foreign policy by blocking the opium trade, so they did that. It's convenient for the makers of pharmaceuticals and pharmacists to not have to deal with the competition of other drugs. And so that's an example of where we had libertarian policies. We have now this war on drugs, which, by the way, is another example of government incompetence because people still use drugs, and so they haven't succeeded at all in eradicating them. So that's an example where we had libertarianism before. We don't have it now, but we could certainly have it again, and there's every reason to think that things could get better.
So, you know, the way you present libertarians, on one hand, they sound like conservatives. On the other hand, they sound like liberals. What are they?
Well, they're neither one. I mean, in a way, they're half of each. I mean, conservatives pay lip service to some libertarian ideas to an extent. They say they want small government. They say they want lower taxes and so on. When you see what the people they elect actually do, they don't seem to really favor those things, but at least they say they do. Mm-hmm. Likewise, liberals will say they favor certain libertarian policies. Some liberals may be opposed to the war on drugs, for example. Some liberals may be anti-war, for example, as libertarians are. But in practice, it usually doesn't work out that way. If you see what's happened since Barack Obama took office, I don't think we've seen any moves in a libertarian direction. Maybe he's slightly better on a couple things, but the liberals who are anti-war and anti-drug war, they don't seem to care about that so much now that their guy's in office. Now that their guy's in office, it's much more important to impose socialized medicine, things of that sort. So even though conservatives and liberals are theoretically half right, arguably, in practice they tend to be not right at all. Libertarians consistently support less government, repeal of government programs.
So where are they joined? They're half right, but they're wrong in one joining point, and that is that they want to use government as an intervention tool for their particular agenda. Would you say that's an accurate statement?
That's exactly right. I mean, they don't share libertarians' fundamental premise, which is that government shouldn't be able to use aggression against peaceful people. Government shouldn't be able to kill and steal. And fundamentally, conservatives and liberals don't agree with that principle. They do think government should be allowed to kill and steal when it's for the things they want government to do. Conservatives want government to kill and steal if they want to wage a war in Iraq, or if they want to stop people from using drugs. Liberals want to do the same thing, to take away money from people who've earned it, from business, redistribute wealth. So neither of them share a libertarian's principled stance in favor of human liberty.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think is really important for people to understand on this whole conversation of libertarianism is that a libertarian is not a libertine per se. So would you comment on that?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, people sometimes react to this. I mean, I've had people say, oh, you're a libertarian. Well, you must believe there's no such thing as personal morality at all. And that's not true. I mean, libertarianism is simply about the relationship between government and people. It's about the idea that government shouldn't be allowed to aggress against people. It has nothing whatsoever to say about how you should live your life. Mm-hmm. Just because I shouldn't be able to use force to stop you from using drugs, that doesn't mean I think you should use them. It just means I shouldn't be able to use force to stop them. Not all morality is subject to being policed by government. It doesn't mean there is no such thing as morality.
In fact, I would think that the entire premise of libertarianism assumes that people are more good, basically, than more bad.
I don't know if that's quite true, because one problem with government is that you know people aren't good and you can't trust them with power.
But it's a question of how many. Let me rephrase that. I like to ask people the question, do you think that people are basically good or are basically bad? Because if they say that people are basically bad, then of course they would be very rational in their support for greater security from the state. And if, on the other hand, they think that people are basically good, they're, in my observation, they're just paying attention to the fact that when they go to the grocery store, when they go to the parks and they drive around, people are not overtly trying to kill each other all the time or steal from each other all the time.
Well, that's true, and I don't think nobody really wants to live in a world where people are doing that. And people want to be able to live peacefully alongside their neighbors. They want to have a decent reputation so that they can continue to interact with other people, so they're welcome in society, in the community, so they're able to go participate in the market and people will trust them. And so when there's a market for freedom, people have an incentive to behave well. Whether they're innately good, I don't know. That's a philosophical question that's maybe beyond me. But the market certainly gives people an incentive to behave well, to develop a good reputation, and to live their life by trading with others, by offering other people services and benefits, instead of by trying to grab what belongs to other people.
Well, I think there's always going to be a place for what I call the ethics business. You know, the various religions always are trying to improve our ethical behavior and create traditions of doing exactly that. And so that I think will always be a part of the landscape and part of the need.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. So let's go back for just a minute. You mentioned that there was a time when conservatives were libertarians, and you mentioned the old right. When Franklin Roosevelt came to power, these people called the old right opposed the New Deal. And when did they lose their battle?
Well, I mean, I guess it was always a losing battle. You know, when Franklin Roosevelt came into power, I mean, the the left of the United States just really rallied behind him. The people who had been anti-war or skeptical of big business and big government getting together to beat up on the little guy, they kind of put all the most people on the left put all that to the side, got behind Roosevelt and said, "Oh no, we need government to do all these big things now. You know, you anti-war people are not with the program." And so FDR was really able to sweep aside most of his opposition. The old right, it wasn't a movement. It was a scattered group of people who took ideas that were opposed to the New Deal, but they weren't really an effective or organized movement. And so they really, unfortunately, never had a chance.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that there was a next generation of conservatives that increasingly favored the Cold War and constraining government at home became a lower priority. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, sure. After World War II, the old right, a lot of those people were getting older. Some of them kind of faded into the background. And into the foreground came, say, William F. Buckley and his magazine, National Review. And Buckley seemed to have some libertarian sympathies. He said he was influenced by one of the great old right thinkers, Albert J. Nock. But his priorities seemed to be on, instead of on libertarian things, on defeating Soviet communism. And that was the number one thing for National Review. He brought in people who were ex-Trotskyites, socialists, and so forth over time, who favored defeating the Soviet Union, but had no particular connection to libertarian ideas that Buckley supposedly liked.
Very good. Well, we're going to take another break, folks, and so please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and we'll be back right after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and with me today is Mr. Jacob Hubert, and Jacob is a lawyer and teaches law. And he's the author of a book, Libertarianism Today, which is going to be coming out in July 2010. And we're getting a sneak preview of this particular book in this conversation, which we titled, Are You Left, Are You Right, or Are You Confused? And so we're talking about the linkage of the libertarian movement right now to the conservative movement. Because it was pretty much identified with the conservative movement for quite a long time. What happened to that?
Well, I think, in that period we were talking about when National Review was first getting started and so forth, libertarians saw some connections there with the conservatives. Conservatives claimed to favor the free market and so forth, and of course they were opposed to communism, and libertarians are opposed to communism. Libertarians just don't want to fight wars over it. So they saw some commonality there. Over time, the divisions started to appear, particularly with the Vietnam War, where the conservatives tended to favor it, and the libertarians found this totally abhorrent, and many libertarians made their permanent break with conservatism right then and there because they could have nothing to do with this pro-war stance. But over time, you know, Barry Goldwater, of course, I should mention, was another major factor. I mean, if you listen to Barry Goldwater's speeches, in many respects, he sounds very much like a libertarian, very much interested in putting liberty first. So that established some connection between conservatives and libertarians.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Ronald Reagan.
Right. And then when you get to Reagan, of course, Reagan's speeches, if a libertarian listens to them, some of them sound very, very good. They sound very libertarian.
Yeah, I mean, he would say that the problem is government.
Exactly. And so that sounds great to libertarians, and a lot of libertarians placed a lot of hope in Reagan scale back government.
But in fact, he actually expanded it dramatically.
He did. I mean, government only got bigger under Reagan. There was deregulation during the Reagan era, but what a lot of people don't realize is airline deregulation, trucking deregulation, these things were actually enacted under President Carter and simply took effect while Reagan was in office. Reagan deregulated very little and at the same time expanded government greatly, particularly with respect to the military, which which counts. I mean, the military is part of big government, and building more nuclear weapons is a terrible thing from a libertarian perspective. Not only is it a waste of money, it threatens the existence of the human race, and it can only be used aggressively. And these are just terrible things from a libertarian perspective. And, of course, the deficit only got bigger and bigger under Reagan, and then suddenly you had former free market economists saying, oh, no, no, deficits don't matter. And to all of this, libertarians are disgusted by all of this, and that's really what happened under Reagan. The reality under Reagan was bigger government, and libertarians, a lot, some of them still don't recognize that because the rhetoric was so good.
So, you know, there's a lot of movement now. There's this Tea Party movement that's growing by leaps and bounds. What is the future for libertarians?
Well, it's hard to say what the future is. I mean, there are very encouraging signs and there are very discouraging signs. The most encouraging thing, of course, is Ron Paul's movement, how he was able to rally so many people and to draw so much interest. And now, of course, he's a major figure in the media. He's invited to comment on things, and he presents, even though he's not a perfectly pure libertarian, basically he presents the libertarian perspective. People know what that is. They respect it. They see it as something different from what other Republicans are offering. And so Ron Paul and his movement offer a great deal of hope. Of course, on the other hand, we see government just getting bigger and bigger, and people becoming more and more depending on it, expecting it to do more things. We see government just kind of, even when people oppose the government, bailing out big businesses and so forth, well, government just goes ahead and does it anyway, and nothing seems to stop them. And so you have this Tea Party movement which kind of reacts to that. I don't know that those people, most of them are libertarians, but they see something wrong in all this. They see that government should be scaled back in some ways, but whether that will succeed or whether it will simply be kind of taken over by the conservative types who will come along with the Reagan-esque rhetoric again and the Reagan-esque results of not really making government smaller remains to be seen. Unfortunately, I think that's probably the more likely scenario.
Well, you made a little side comment there that Ron Paul is not a pure libertarian. In what way would you contrast him with being a pure libertarian?
Well, Ron Paul says he always goes back to the U.S. Constitution, and the U.S. Constitution isn't necessarily a libertarian document. The U.S. Constitution establishes a government, potentially a big federal government. I mean, the U.S. Constitution gave us the government we have now, and even though, you know, Ron Paul says rightly that that the courts have interpreted things too broadly to give government too much power, the fact is the Constitution hasn't been very successful in restraining government. I mean, Ron Paul doesn't want to abolish the military. He just wants to bring the troops home, but he would still pay for that. So there are little things like that where Ron Paul isn't quite a pure libertarian, but I certainly wouldn't want to emphasize those because overall, I mean, he is a libertarian. He's all about genuinely scaling back government, genuinely about repealing the income tax and replacing it with nothing. So no question about it, Ron Paul is a great libertarian.
Yeah, and we do see an incredible growth in particularly among young people in recognizing this. You know, do you think that this is primarily a young people movement at this point?
I think it is. I mean, I think Ron Paul has a special appeal for young people. He's getting people on campuses, and I've seen some of them, and they get excited about this. And what's exciting to me about it is they're getting into the real hardcore libertarianism. Ron Paul is leading people to the Mises Institute, to read works by Murray Rothbard, and these people are really learning what true libertarianism is all about. So it's very exciting to see.
Yeah, we like to emphasize that everyone should actually visit the Mises Institute's website, Mises.org, Mises.org. And we're going to conclude this particular segment. We'll be back right after the break. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. Please stay with us. And we're back. Welcome, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and I'm speaking with Mr. Jacob Hubert. We're talking about libertarianism today. And Jacob, let's talk about today. Did the free market and deregulation cause this current economic crisis?
No, nothing could be less true.
Well, tell us more on that.
Well, you do hear people out there making this claim. It's unbelievable. You have people like Judge Richard Posner who are out there writing that, well, the reason we have this free market or this monetary financial crisis today is because the Bush administration was so wedded to free market policies. But the fact is, we didn't have anything like free market policies, and so it's an odd claim, and it's not true at all. You know, we have a Federal Reserve that is in charge of our money system. We don't have a free market in money, and that's what libertarians favor. Libertarians recognize that money is something that originally came about in the free market because people want to trade with each other, and they need something that they can use as a medium of exchange, and they choose money to do that, and people found gold to use as a medium of exchange or other metals. And money arose naturally on the market that way. What we have today with our slips of paper from the government that are used in place of money, and government controls this and uses it to manipulate the economy through the Federal Reserve. For most of America's history, we did not have a Federal Reserve. We didn't have perfect free market money. We had a lot of government control over it. But nonetheless, we had something a little more like that, where banks actually did have gold. You could redeem your currency for gold, and so banks were restrained in the amount of money they could print up. The government uses the Federal Reserve to get around that. The government, if it really needs money, in effect, can print that money, and the Federal Reserve allows it to do that. And through its money printing, the Federal Reserve affects interest rates, and it can make interest rates lower than they would otherwise be on the free market. And that's really what we saw leading up to our current economic crisis, the Fed making credit too easy because it's allowed to do so, because the government monopoly that it has lets them do so. And that's the sort of thing that gave rise to our crisis. And you know, these people will say, well, it's because we didn't have enough regulation of these people. Well, but if you add more regulation on top of the way banks operate, the way investment firms operate, this is just piling regulation on top of more regulation. As we said earlier, there are lots of reasons to think the government isn't competent to figure out how to regulate anybody anyway. So more regulation for libertarians isn't really the answer. The answer is to scale back government, to get back to free market money, where you don't have this government manipulation of the economy.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to do something unusual at this point. These points that you just made are so excellent, and I want people who are very interested in learning more about money and how it works, which is something that we are very, very committed to at Radio Free Market, to go back into our archives and actually listen to three shows in particular that I think will actually help you really understand this. One is an interview with Mr. Doug French. He was the president of the Mises Institute, and we had him on in early February. And, of course, Jeffrey Herbner, who is the head of the economic department at Grove City College, and we had a primer show on the ABCs of hyperinflation. And then also one that we've had recently with Mark Thornton, on money and monetary theory. And so you can access those shows at Radio Free Market under our archives. You can download those for free, and we hope that you will. Okay, so, Jacob, how are we going to prevent this next crisis? I mean, obviously, if the Federal Reserve is going to continue this policy of planned inflation and continually creating this money that is backed by nothing, they are actually institutionalized to create the boom and bust cycles. So how can a next crisis be prevented?
Well, as long as you have a Federal Reserve that can do this, I think it's very unlikely that you're going to avoid future booms and busts. As long as you have a government that can do this, that's going to inflate the money supply, then you're going to be subject to this kind of disruption in the economy. Mm-hmm. The only way to really get rid of this is to make a sounder monetary system. I mean, one step you could take would be at least to go back to a gold standard type system where government has to be able to redeem the money that it prints in gold, and therefore it's constrained to some extent in how much money it can print up and how much it can manipulate. Another alternative would be at least to allow individuals to use their own money, to allow people to choose, well, do I want to use the U.S. dollar, or maybe I want to use some form of free market money for my exchanges, make the U.S. dollar not legal tender anymore, and so the government sort of has to.
Let's explain that to people. The idea of repealing legal tender laws is something that's new to a lot of people. legal tender laws basically force people to use a particular kind of money.
Yeah, that's right. It says right on your dollar bills, it's for all debts, public and private, meaning that if someone wants to enforce a contract with you, they can make you pay in dollars. It means basically for all of your transactions that you do in the United States, you have to pay in dollars. But people might prefer not to hold dollars or transact in dollars if they had a choice. People might rather use a money that's backed by gold, that's not going to lose its value as the dollar has since the Federal Reserve came about. So repealing the legal tender laws would create more monetary soundness, allow people to move to a money that isn't going to be destroyed in the way that government has destroyed the dollar. Mm-hmm. And that in turn should hopefully mitigate the effects of the business cycle that the Fed causes. Mm-hmm. And of course, ideally, we want to abolish the Fed entirely, get government out of money entirely, because libertarians see no justification for that, no need for that.
So two practical things that are happening right now is that this awareness that people have that having competitive monies may actually be good for them, that's one thing. The other is Ron Paul's popular legislation to audit the Fed. Has 300 at this particular moment that we're taping this, 371, I believe, co-sponsors in the House, but it is being actually prohibited from coming to a vote. And in fact, actually, it's just a slight expansion of the audit that has actually been in force since the 1970s, as I understand it. But it allows the U.S. people, the people of America, to actually see a little bit more of just what the Fed is doing and how they are actually doing it. But they are fighting transparency tooth and nail. And that's a definite problem. The other thing that I've mentioned before to people is this ongoing lawsuit that was initiated in November of 2008 by Bloomberg, where they actually sued the Federal Reserve to disclose who the Federal Reserve gave $2 trillion to. And the Federal Reserve has openly said no, right in front of Congress. They've said, no, we're not going to say who that is. Now, they lost that lawsuit in August of 2009, but they are appealing it at this particular moment, and we anticipate that they'll probably be appealing it for quite some time.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that the Fed is going to fight this tooth and nail, because they don't want people to know what they do. And, you know, I think even if they get audited, they're probably going to find ways to cover up what they do to the best of their ability. I don't think they're, you know, people are going to be shocked and abolish the Fed overnight because of this. But simply by putting it in the news, by making it an issue, a popular issue, Ron Paul is leading people to check these things out, to go online and find out what the Fed is all about, to look at the important books by Rothbard and others on the Fed, and to see and to learn more about this. And it's that education that over time will make the difference. Eventually, as more and more of this stuff goes on, more and more people will learn about it, and that'll take us closer to the day when people are ready to really push for free market money.
Yes, I in particular like to push Rothbard's book, What Has Government Done to Our Money? And that can be read, by the way, for free at the Mises website at mises.org.
Yeah, it's great that that's online for people to read. I recommend that book as well. One of my favorite things that I do in this book, by the way, is recommend books, including that one, with the URLs right there that people can pull up the books for free on mises.org.
That's an excellent book. I think that has turned the heads of an awful lot of people who didn't understand the really fundamental basics about money, and that's a fantastic book for that. So, all right, so we've talked about that. Now let's talk about, well, how are we going to get out of this? How are we going to get out of the current crisis that we are in? We see ourselves kind of like in the tar pit. And what is the action that would take us out of this?
Well, the only thing you can do at this point is to stop printing money, stop bailing out businesses that have failed, stop spending more money that's going to have to be taken from somebody in the form of taxes or through even more money printing down the road to try to stimulate the economy, because these things aren't going to work. You know, libertarians First of all, as a principled matter, libertarians would say, well, you shouldn't steal from people to pay for these bailouts and so forth. But libertarians also, many of them, subscribe to the Austrian School of Economics, which explains why money printing and stimulus and bailouts will not actually produce economic growth, but will actually cause more economic harm. And so the main thing for government to do is to just stop doing harm, let the market recover on its own, let people go about their business without further disruptions from government.
You know, I want to jump back into another topic that is actually a whole chapter in your book on the fight for marijuana and other drugs to be legalized. And I wanted to introduce this by a little comment that in Iowa recently, the State Board of Pharmacy voted unanimously, that's 6-0, to recommend medical marijuana be implemented in Iowa. But what's really unique about this is that this is the first state in the union to actually have its Board of Pharmacy make this recommendation without some form of legislation or some form of judicial push, forcing this or initiating this process. And so this is actually a very, very positive sign. And I'm actually thinking that this is a sign that maybe idea of medical marijuana being legalized is an idea that is winning. Is that your perception?
It might be. Certainly, if they're accepting it in Iowa, that's a good sign that they might accept it everywhere else in the country. And you see more and more medical marijuana initiatives. People are behind this. People tend to recognize that, look, if marijuana is a medicine that helps people, why shouldn't they be allowed to take it just because some other people use it recreationally? And you may see even pushes for marijuana be legalized for other purposes. I know I think it's going to be a ballot initiative coming up in California to make it entirely illegal. And, of course,
illegal?
Entirely legal in California.
Okay.
To possess and use marijuana. And because that state, I think, thinks that they can tax it and their struggling government can make some money off of it. And if that's how it has to come about, that's fair enough, and that's more freedom, and it's a good thing.
I did see that one report that said that one state legislator wanted to put $150 per unit tax, which would basically just create a black market in California. So we'll have to watch that very closely as to how they plan on implementing that.
Well, at least even if they have a really heavy tax like that on it, well, say you have some black market marijuana on you, well, how are they going to prove whether it's black market or not once you have it? So at least maybe it'll stop government from persecuting innocent consumers of marijuana, and then maybe they'll go after marijuana sellers or whatever, but it sounds like a step in the right direction at least to leave those users alone, because it's crazy to put people in jail for possessing marijuana.
Now, you mentioned a libertarian activist. You mentioned several of them in your book, one of them by the name of Peter McWilliams, who is an author who wrote a number of books in the 1970s. And I mentioned to you during the break that I, just as an aside, I happen to know him personally. We were both from the Detroit area. We met in a completely different venue some 40 years ago. But I know that he died as a sufferer of AIDS. And quite an outspoken advocate of legalization, as many other people have. So the human toll that this journey and struggle has had has just been enormous.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Peter McWilliams has had a particularly sad story where he definitely needed medical marijuana to keep his medications down, to keep food down. And nothing else would work for him but to treat his nausea. And the government just didn't care. At that time, medical marijuana was not legal in California as it is now. And they would not let him have it for that purpose. And he could not keep his medications down. And they prosecuted him. And in the process of all that going on, he died. Mm-hmm. And that's the effect of keeping marijuana illegal. And it's just it's incredibly heartless that they do this, but they do.
So let's bridge out of this to go into the broader conversation of the fight for our health freedom. It's a very big topic today, this whole healthcare debate. How do libertarians think about this?
Well, libertarians are happy to see conservatives, you know, as they stand up to Obamacare and they go out and protest at these town halls they were having last year. And so that's sort of encouraging to libertarians to see conservatives go out and do that. But libertarians have an important difference from conservatives. Conservatives just want to typically cheer the system we have, call it the best healthcare system in the world. How could anybody not like it? But libertarians don't go along with all that because our healthcare system has tremendous problems. It does us no good to pretend that it doesn't. It is very expensive. It's much more expensive than it needs to be. And the reason is not private greed or anything like that. The reason is government doing things that has driven the cost of healthcare and the availability of healthcare, has driven the cost of healthcare way up and driven the availability of healthcare down.
Mm-hmm. So libertarians aren't likely to be cheering the current system. And what do libertarians propose to fix the healthcare system?
Well, one of the biggest problems with the current system is that we have a tax system that pushes everybody to buy insurance. This is one of those temporary wartime things that became permanent. In World War II, you had wage controls. The employers couldn't charge above a certain amount, but they had to do things.
Couldn't pay above a certain amount.
I'm sorry, yes, couldn't pay above a certain amount. Right. And so they had to do things to attract workers. And one way they could do this was offering health insurance, which was also tax exempt. And after the war, health insurance, people were used to getting it from their employers. They still had this tax exempt status. And so that pushed employers to include health insurance as part of workers' benefits. And people came to expect this.
That's very interesting because, one of my basic premises is that a luxury once experienced becomes a necessity. And so people started experiencing this quote-unquote free health care or health insurance, and they decided this is what they were always going to require, and they deserve to have it, and employers were kind of caught. We're going to have to take a break, folks. This is going to take us off for just a couple of minutes, but then we're going to come back, and we want you to stay with us. This is Radio Free Market. I am your host, Michael McKay, and we're talking about libertarianism today. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and I'm talking to Jacob Hubert, and we're talking about libertarianism today. And we were talking about what do libertarians actually propose to fix this current healthcare mess that we're in. Jacob, please reiterate that first point that you made just before the break.
So we have this tax system that pushes people to get insurance. And because everyone is being pushed to buy insurance, that drives the price of insurance up. Then, when people have insurance, they use more health resources than they otherwise would. This drives the cost of services up. They're not checking prices of services like they would if they were just paying for it out of their pocket. Mm-hmm. So one libertarian reform is, don't distort the market with the tax code. If you want to cut people's taxes to make up for this, that's great. You should do that. But don't make any special tax exemption to push people to buy some particular product over another because it causes this bad distortion. Another thing libertarians propose to do is abolish the FDA. The FDA makes drugs expensive. The FDA keeps potentially life-saving drugs out of people's hands. So that's another important thing libertarians point to. Another thing related to the health insurance market is, if we are going to the extent we do have health insurance, it needs to be really genuinely deregulated. Mm-hmm. Right now, the government forces insurance companies to provide insurance at the same rate to a group of people, regardless of whether those people face different risks, like maybe they have a different ages, they have different genetic factors. Many times, government says you can't take these things into account. Or it forces insurance companies to pay for things like pregnancy, which aren't really a normal risk. It's something people do deliberately that they could avoid if they want to. Mm-hmm. That's not the sort of thing insurance was meant to pay for. Mm-hmm. So libertarians say, abolish these regulations. It'll make the cost of insurance, particularly for people who take care of themselves and don't engage in risky behaviors, it'll take the cost of insurance down for them, reduce their health care costs, reduce insurance costs.
Well, the other aspect of the insurance deregulation has to be the allowing for insurance companies to actually compete across state lines, because right now they can't do that.
Right. That's another thing, that's another part of deregulation that's important. That's one that actually mainstream Republican politicians have put on the table. So maybe we'll see some positive advances in that one. But the rest of it has to go along with it, too, if we're going to have
actually, I looked at this mathematically, and there's some 1,300 carriers that are actually offering health insurance policies, but not all of them do so across in various different state lines.
Right.
And the reason that they don't is because they would basically have to set up 50 different risk pools, 50 different processing centers or processing processes, if you will. And when you do the math on that, it comes over to 60,000 different kinds of business entities that they would have to create. And so it's just completely onerous. There's no incentive for an insurance company to actually do that. It's much more efficient for them just to focus on a particular group or a particular area and go from that particular that angle of it. So, you know, opening up the insurance industry to actual competition so that people could buy insurance across state lines, they could shop for it, they could actually move with it and transfer it, that would be a big boon.
Yep, no question about it.
So talk about this this other rather interesting idea of legalizing the sale of organs.
Well, that's another area where government just effectively kills people by not letting them have their freedom. If you need an organ, you have to go through this system where you're not allowed to pay for an organ. You have to go on a list and hope that somebody dies in time for you to get your organ. Libertarians say abolish this, let organs be paid for, and more people would have organs. And if we had time, we could talk about why the poor wouldn't have to worry so much about getting an organ, even if they had to pay. And it's just one more important issue.
Yes. Well, we're coming to the end of our show today, folks. You know, this concept of the ideal of libertarianism presents a ideal that may be unattainable. But at the same time, Jacob, I want to thank you very much for writing this important book. But it gives us an ideal that we can all really aspire for.
Yep, that's the idea. Put the ideal out there, and maybe someday we can come close.
And actually, the ideal is really centered on the concept of cooperation. So thank you very much, everyone. This has been a wonderful show. We've been very happy to have our guest, Mr. Jacob Hubert. And I would invite everyone to please come and visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com. This is Michael McKay, and I thank you again for listening today and look forward to hearing from you and talking to you again next week. Thank you very much for listening.